In the year 1264, Simon de Montfort was effectively the uncrowned King of England. He had just led his forces to an incredible victory at the Battle of Lewes, capturing the king, and one group of his supporters, the Citizen Army of London, had been pivotal to that victory. They had not helped him by winning anything. London's forces had been a sacrificial lamb, whose massacre beneath the hooves of the cavalry commanded by Edward, the heir to the throne's rampaging forces, had been enough to allow de Montfort secure an unusual and surprising victory. And so we begin with this victory, this glory. London once again on the winning side in a fight against the dynasty of the Plantagenets. For the second time this century, London had thrown its lot in with forces whose intent was to curtail the powers of the King of England. And for the second time this century, they had won. And also, for the second time this century, they were about to discover that winning the war is not the same as securing the peace. And the consequences of what they did was about to haunt the city for a very long time indeed. Hi, my name is Saul, and I would like to welcome you to this, The Story of London, the weekly podcast that attempts to explain the long and complicated and rather detailed story, the history of the city, as a single narrative tale. We begin this episode in the aftermath of the Battle of Lewes and the rise of Simon de Montfort, which was to see London witness things it could never have conceived of, and how all of this was to come crashing down upon the city with de Montfort's defeat. Welcome then to chapter 98 of The Story of London, The Thunder of Retribution. In 1264, a monk, possibly educated in Oxford, wrote a poem. It was a highly political poem. It was the poem of a revolutionary movement. And its language, here translated from Latin, may clear the mood and the tone of the writer and the cause he was supporting at that time. Quote, "The proud people are fallen. The faithful are glad. Now England breathes again, hoping for liberty. To whom may God's grace grant prosperity? The English, likened unto dogs, were become vile, but now they have raised their head over their vanquished foes." Unquote. This poem, known as The Song of Lewes, was composed by that monk very soon after the Battle of Lewes, in support of the forces of Simon de Montfort and the barons who'd just beaten the king. Yes, this whole poem is propaganda for their cause. But it was not the only poem of the time celebrating what had just happened. There was another poem, also called The Song of Lewes, which was composed in Old English. This was a proper song. Who did it? We don't know. And while I will not inflict my singing upon you, heaven forbid, we can read its lyrics and see another poem, one that was sung over fireplaces in London and perhaps, and maybe even to the milling crowds around St. Paul's Cross. Quote, "Sitteth all still and hearkeneth to me. The King of Almaine, by my lote, £30,000 he asked he for to make the peace in this country. And so he did more. Richard, though thou be ever treachered, treachin shall thou nevermore." Unquote. Now, some translation, "by my lote" means "by my honour," and "treachered" and "trickin" are variations of the word treason and betrayer. And basically that last line is translated, "Richard, even though you are a liar, you will not lie any more." And here we see a different kind of celebration of the Battle of Lewes. What's interesting about this poem is that they're not singing against the king. The singing against the men who were his allies, his crucial supporters. And in this case, the poem is about Earl Richard of Cornwall, the king's brother, who'd been elected king of Germany. That's why he's called the King of Almain in the poem. And he's named as being the chief culprit in leading the king astray. Richard, thou be ever Trichard, Trichin shalt thou be nevermore. The real difference between the two poems is one of class. One's written by an educated monk in Latin, composed and spoken as a propaganda piece to the great and good. The other comes from below, from the people of the land itself, the residents of the villages and the towns and cities of England. But they were basically saying the same things. In the Latin version, for example, it also stresses that it was not the king's fault for all this fighting, but the actions of the deeds of the men who surrounded him that had caused this calamity. And they were, like the Old English version suggested, people who demanded money and had bled England dry. Quote, "For those and like deeds they deserve to yield and fall before their foes. May the Lord bless Simon de Montfort, his sons no less and his company, who nobly exposing themselves to death, fought bravely, pitying the mournful lot of the English, who trampled in a manner that can hardly be described, and well nigh deprived of all liberties, nay, of their life, languished under hard princes, even as the people of Israel under Pharaoh, groaning under a tyrannical devastation," unquote. Isn't it all stirring stuff? Isn't Simon de Montfort or Simon de Montfort such a hero? It's really interesting, the line there, where it says the poor English who were trampled on in the manner that could hardly be described, makes one wonder if this is actually referring to what happened to the Londoners at the Battle of Lewes. The poor song of Lewes repeats a similar motif to the posh one. Quote, "Sire Simon de Montfort hath sworn by his top, Hevidi he now here Sir Hugh de begot, all he should acquite here 12 months Scot, should he never more for his footpot to help Windsor. Richard, thou though be ever Trichard, Trichin shall there be never more," unquote. Again, here's the image of Simon de Montfort bravely defending the people. And in this case, he's defending them from Sir Hugh de Bigot, the former justiciar of the realm, who basically at one point was a de facto ruler of England, as we covered in a previous chapter, ruling in the name of the Committee of 15 Barons appointed after the Mad Parliament had insisted upon the provisions of Oxford. And here this poem lambasts him over his greed and financial desires and his support to help Windsor, the headquarters of the royalist faction. And where both poems also hit on identical pitch and tone was their attitudes towards the heir of the throne, Edward, the young prince, whose hatred of London had perhaps driven his murderous successes upon the field of Lewes. In the Latin poem, there is a scolding tone towards the young prince, like a stern father rebuking a wilful and wayward son. Quote, "Oh, Edward, thou dost wish to become king without law? Verily, they would be wretched who were ruled by such a king. For what is more right than law, whereby all things are ruled? And what is more true than justice, whereby matters are decided? If thou desirest the kingdom, reverence the laws. The attacking of the law will give rough roads, rough and impassable roads, which will not lead thee through. If thou dost guard the laws, they shine as a lamp. Therefore avoid and abhor treachery. Be zealous for the truth, hate falsehood. Though treachery may flourish, it cannot bear fruit," unquote. The poorer person's version of the Song of Lewes, however, is equally as scathing, but with a different message. Quote, "Be thee loath, be thee louth, Sire Edward. Thou shalt ride spoils, O thy liar, all the right way to Doverward. Shalt thou nevermore break forward, and that rueth sore," unquote. Here the poem is calling him pitiful and a liar, and an image of a weak and wet tide withdrawing from reality, and with the prince now left to ruminate upon his folly in Dover Castle. And it ends with two really insulting lines, quote, "Edward, thou durst as assured forsaken thine Emmons lore, unquote. And forgive my bad pronunciation of the old English, and it's basically saying, Edward, you acted like a scoundrel, and you left your charges for dead, perhaps suggesting Prince Edward acted dishonourably, leaving his uncle and father on the battlefield. Biting words. And perhaps if recited, they even carried a double meaning. Edward acted dishonourably by attacking the Londoners so intently. These couple of scattered poems are only insight into the mindset of the victors of the Battle of Lewes. They hint at the tone and attitude of London as the remains of their armed forces, many injured, many more dead, were returned to the city. They are a vindication of the cause of the supporters of De Montfort. And, well, you can see it in their lyrics. They won, so they get to say they were loyal sons of the king and his allies and supporters were fools and traitors. And in the aftermath of the Battle of Lewes, we read from the records of London events which reveal that the above poems were not bards written long after these events. They were poems written at the time. Quote, afterwards, on the Tuesday before Ascension Day, the peace between the king and the barons was proclaimed in London. And on the morrow, the army of the barons came to London, and his lordship the king with his own people, and also the king of Almaine and many prisoners who had been taken in the aforesaid battle. Sir Edward and Sir Henry of Almaine, who were hostages, as already stated, being kept in custody in Dover Castle, the king of Almaine, however, and many other prisoners were put in the Tower of London. As to his lordship the king, he was lodged at St. Paul's, when many members of his household were removed from him, added to which nothing was allowed to him or the king of Almaine until they had delivered their hostages unto the barons, unquote. Here we see a victorious London and the king, well, he's under house arrest in St. Paul's. Watching their enemies suffer would have provided at least some reward for their sacrifices at the Battle of Lewes. The king kept in St. Paul's, his household stripped down to its bare bones, his most noble supporters over in the Tower of London under armed guard, his son and nephew stuck down in Dover Castle. The victorious forces could afford to act graciously towards their defeated king. We're doing this for your own good, Your Majesty. But in a letter the king sent to Simon de Montfort, the king reveals his attitude to everyone being polite and informing him the defeat he just suffered wasn't against him, but upon those who led him astray. Quote, it is manifestly evident that you do not regard the fealty that is from you is due unto us, nor do care in any way for the safety of our person, seeing too that you have outrageously aggrieved the nobles and our other faithful subjects, who with constancy do adhere unto their fealty to us, and do to the utmost of your power, we considering the grievance of them to be our own grievance, do care nothing for your assurances or for your love, but as being our enemies, do defy you, unquote. Yep, the king had clearly wasn't in a forgiving mood, and neither was his brother, Earl Richard in the Tower of London. He also wrote to his enemies, and there's a very interesting line in his letter to the barons and their supporters. Quote, from your letters which you have sent unto the illustrious King of England, our most dear lord, we have heard that we, by you, are defied, although this, your verbal defiance, has already been sufficiently proved unto us by the fact of your hostility in the destruction by fire of our property and the laying waste of our possessions, unquote. Now, the thing is in that line, we know this from last chapter, the destruction of his property and the burning of his lands and the laying waste of his possessions, that was done by the army of London, Ober and Isleworth. And it suddenly it appears as if he's writing specifically to the residents of London now. And now that London has won, quote, we therefore do wish you to know that you, as public enemies by enemies, are defied by all and singular of us, and that from this time forward we will, with all our mind and our strength, wheresoever we shall have the means of doing so, do our utmost to inflict injury alike upon your persons and your possessions." Unquote. Yeah, the royal party was now somewhat homicidally inclined towards London. That was it. London had crossed the Rubicon in the minds of the defeated royal faction. London had to win this war. The new regime of England needed to consolidate their power, and fast, and they did not hang around. Quote, "Then the bishops and the barons held a parliament, in which it was ordained, as it was set forth from the letters of his lordship the king, which he himself made and sealed with his seal, which letters began as follows. For the reformation of the present state of the realm, there shall be chosen 3 of the most discreet persons off the realm." Unquote. A new triumvirate was established to run England. For the Lords Clerical, the Bishop of Winchester was appointed, and from the Lords Marshal, you have the young Earl of Gloucester and the Earl of Leicester, Simon de Montfort. The bishop seemed content to just rubber stamp whatever the other two came up with, and due to the age gap, de Montfort was the senior partner and became the visible figurehead and face of the new regime, earning for him the idea that has been passed down through history that he was in effect the uncrowned King of England, running the country in the name of the king who was basically his glove puppet. But for London, as down the road in Westminster, the Parliament made new measures and rules to deal with the aftermath of the fighting, which had been, so far, mercifully limited compared to the First Barons' War. They were now in the heart of the new regime. They would have known that the dangers to their victories were not abated. Indeed, they were waiting for a new wave of attacks, and specifically, quote, "At this season, because news came that through the Queen's contrivance and that of Peter de Savoy, John Earl of Warin, Hugh Bigot, William de Valence, John Mansell, and others, who were then in parts beyond the sea, certain aliens intended to invade the Kingdom of England by force of arms." Unquote. The supporters of the King and his faction over in France and elsewhere were threatening to come and invade England. And this was a real threat. It had only been a generation or so before that the last invasion had happened. And yes, let's avoid the fact that London had invited that invasion under Prince Louis of France to come over, shall we? But here we are, and the powerful supporters of the king were threatening to do it again. De Montfort and his Trinity, with the power of the royal seal and Parliament behind them, in panic, issued a new proclamation. Well, the edict was written in the name of the king, written as if it came from the king. Behind it was the new regime hitting the panic button. Quote, "Whereas we have heard for certain that a great multitude of aliens, collecting ships from every quarter, are making preparations to enter our realm by force of arms, to the confusion and the everlasting disherison of us all, we shall deem it proper to meet them with a strong hand. We do command you, in virtue of the fealty in which unto us you are bound, that manually and strenuously you do forth with equip with horses and with arms all knights and freeholders who shall thereunto suffice, that you will be with us at London with all your array on the Sunday next after the feast of St. Peter in Chains, to proceed with us forthwith against such aliens in defence by us and by you of all this realm." Unquote. So yeah, in fear of this invasion, the regime marshalled the entire kingdom and said that on August 1st, 1264, this great host was to gather in London, the centre now of the nation in all ways. And London records are clear that this indeed did happen. The new regime placed the nation on a war footing. Quote, "After this, in obedience with the precept of the before stated writ, countless multitudes of horse and foot gathered together from all the counties of England, and, well provided with arms, set out for the sea coast to defend the realm against aliens, and in like manner, numerous ships of the Cinque Ports and other places put to sea with crews well armed for the purpose of resisting said aliens with a strong hand." Unquote. So from London then, the central marshalling yard of the country, The armed might of England, such as it was sent forth to repel the invaders. And there wasn't any invasion, so who knows? Maybe that worked. Maybe it put them off. But the sense of ongoing war and crisis continued. And we also get the impression that the new regime and its supporters were too busy focusing on the defence of their new power than focusing on the smooth functioning of the state itself. Again, London records hint at this. Quote, "Be it remembered that Thomas FitzThomas, who in the preceding year had been elected mayor, though he had not been admitted, still remained in office throughout the whole year. But in that year, no pleas of the land were pleaded, and also pleas of the plaint made, which pertained to the assizes, nor were any hustings held. Hence it was that no affidavits as to tenements were sworn from foreign courts, nor was any testament proved. The same Thomas also was again elected mayor on the feast of St. Simon and Jude, and on the morrow admitted by the king," unquote. So here we are in the summer and autumn of 1264, and the crisis of the new regime is continuing. From reading what the Parliament back in 1264 was dealing with, widespread disorder was prevalent throughout the land. The rebels had removed the political opposition to themselves, but they had not regained a firm enough hand to maintain peace throughout the kingdom, and the boring, mundane business of the kingdom was stalling. Into this tumult then, on October 28th, Thomas FitzThomas entered his fourth year as mayor of London, the radical mayor, the man who bypassed the traditional powers of the city and showed that if you appealed to the people directly, you could find political success. Which is an interesting example, don't you think? And slowly, London did begin to get back to the business of running the city. We read that on the 2nd of November that year, quote, "It was provided in the hustings on the morrow of All Souls that all measures by which wine, ale, and other liquors are sold should be of the same dimensions, the mouth of a gallon being ordered to measure 4 inches across. On the same day, it was enacted and provided that no advocate should be an estoneur in the hustings or in any of the other city courts," unquote. So here we see Thomas FitzThomas get back to the important things, making sure the measures of booze were consistent and fair and regulated, and also ending legal loopholes in proceedings that worked against people without cash. You know, reform, improving things. As we enter November and December of 1264, we can see here, amidst all the chaos and carnage of an unstable national regime, Thomas FitzThomas was able to govern London. And don't forget, he's doing this by not depending upon the oligarchs, the Esquivins of London. Thomas FitzThomas is providing stable social leadership over the largest city in the realm by appealing to as many of the citizens as possible. And this is why I asked you if you can thought it was a good example. Because it was during this exact period, this exact moment in time, with the regime of the triumvirate struggling to get control, and with the largest community right in front of them doing what they were doing, that Simon de Montfort had a wild idea. And his wild idea, well, why not try and hold a parliament that also tries to bypass the existing powers that be? Why not do what FitzThomas has been doing for the last 4 years and appeal to the people? On December 14th, 1264, Simon de Montfort summoned a parliament to come to Westminster for the end of January the next year. But in this he did something no one had ever done before. He summoned the nobles, who since John's reign had gotten used to this place where the crown asked them for money and they could leverage this into gaining concessions from the crown about how they run things. He summoned the clergy, who were due to turn up, because you didn't ignore the clergy, and then sort of followed the nobles into this parliament thing. And the reforming parliaments of the years before had made it so that every shire would send 2 knights, lower-ranked nobles, to turn up and represent them at this important talking shop. But this time de Montfort appealed to the people directly. He included in his summons two burgesses from the major towns of England, from York and Norwich, from Dover and Sandwich, from Lincoln and from London. He was playing the card played by Thomas FitzThomas these last 4 years. No, he could not appeal to all the people across England, please, but he would summon for the first time to discuss how to run the nation those who did not hold authority by force of arms or force of faith. He summoned, as best he could, the people's representatives. This moment is marked as the first true Parliament of England, here, now, just down the river from London, at the start of 1265. But for all of this, while it was the start of the first true Parliament of England, it wasn't our version of Parliament. It was not an attempt to place the reins of power into any kind of electorate, please. This is not a democracy. It was, at the time, an utterly partisan move designed to get supporters into this body. Understand, most of the nobles did not attend because they didn't want to stick their necks out or to oppose the king. Even the barons from the shires had a fairly poor attendance because most of them were still seeing which way the wind was blowing. And sure, the clergy turned up, but they were supportive of all of this in a soft way. For de Montfort to have legitimacy in 1265, he needed people who would agree with him. So he tapped the already partisan and sharing his way of thinking burgesses of the English towns to turn up. It is a delicious irony that we're told, and it's often seen, that Simon de Montfort was some defender of Englishness and English liberties, when in truth, Simon de Montfort was a French-raised noble who didn't even speak English, and who grasped it badly at best, and whose links to the land were because people like Thomas FitzThomas in London had seen the unity of purpose with this fanatical crusader. Whatever the reason, in early January, London records clearly say, quote, "There came to London by summons of his lordship the king and all the bishops, abbots, priors, earls and barons of the whole realm, and also the barons of the cinque ports and four men of every city and borough to hold a parliament, in which parliament, on St. Valentine's Day, was made known in the chapter house at Westminster that his lordship the king had bound himself to his charter on oath, that neither he nor Sir Edward would thenceforth aggrieve or cause to be aggrieved the earls of Leicester or Gloucester or the citizens of London or any of those who sided with them on pretense of anything done in the time of past commotions in the realm," unquote. Oh, look, the king has been forced to sign a general pardon and amnesty. All's back to peace. See, we've got the king's support. Parliament says so. The purpose of the Parliament was to calm things down, create a bit of stability, and guess what? It did. The tensions and underlying cause of them seemed to die down. We know that by March, Prince Edward was being escorted back to Westminster, and, quote, "Before all the people in the Great Hall at Westminster, which at the same time there were read certain letters obligatory to his lordship the King and Sir Edward, in which was set forth how and under what penalties they would, upon oath, had promised to maintain the peace and tranquillity of the realm. And then 9 bishops arrayed in pontificals with lighted tapers pronounced excommunicate all those who should presume to do aught against the Charter of Liberties and the Forest or against the statutes which had been enacted in the preceding year," unquote. The political fix within. De Montfort hanging on to this wild ride and holding on for dear life, wherever this journey was taking him. And the Parliament, which seemed to solve this, promised to offer stability and placed what was hoped was a final muzzle on the king and his heir. This done, quote, "The mayor and alderman of London in the church of St. Paul did fealty to his lordship the king, who was there present. And on the Sunday following, all persons in the city at the age of 12 years and upwards made the same oath, each before his own alderman in his own ward," unquote. For the residents of London, this was it. Everything was now in a new order. They had won, the king had reconciled. It was done, right? Right? In the end, the new regime of Simon de Montfort had less than 4 months left in it. The cause of the fall lay in the nature of the men involved in itself. The Trinity in charge of England fell apart. De Montfort, we read, used his position to line the pockets of his family. But given what we've seen taking place over the last few centuries in England at every single level of society, who didn't do that? Like, seriously. Be that as it may, this happened, and then London records point out there was a big clash, quote, between Easter and Pentecost there arose certain dissensions between the Earl of Gloucester and the Earl of Leicester, unquote, which really was the death knell for the regime. The two men needed to work together to make this whole situation work. They fell out, and Gloucester sided now with the king. This is not to say that people were still not trying desperately to just run society around this period while ignoring the crisis. I mean, we read that around the end of June, quote, certain persons who had followed the army of Simon de Montfort to London and who had been convicted of the commissions of robbery in Stepney and Hackney were hanged, unquote. Suggesting the function of law and order was still ongoing, that London was trying to deal with men who had joined the army and then afterwards had turned to crime around Stepney and Hackney. Remember, these weren't suburbs of London, they were villages away from it. But no matter what they did, it didn't really matter. Prince Edward escaped the house arrest he was on, supposedly by using trickery. And the war between de Montfort and the king flared up again. De Montfort was outmaneuvered. Near the sleepy and wonderful little Warwickshire village of Evesham, his forces were outmaneuvered by the royalist and led by Edward, furious Prince Edward. Simon de Montfort was fallen upon and his army was destroyed and he was killed. And when sometimes I wonder if I portray Prince Edward too simplistically, that me saying in my head is this furious, angry young man with a chip on both his shoulders, I'm being completely unfair. Well, I always look at what happened after the Battle of Evesham. How, under Edward's direct orders, the body of Simon de Montfort was taken and brutally mutilated. Edward specifically ordered the man's testicles to be removed and then hung on either side of his nose and his decapitated head to be sent to the wife of one of his supporters. No, I think I've got the measure of Prince Edward's character just right. And he had helped his father win. It was over. The king was back. And the London records say, quote, on the same day and at the same hour that the battle took place, there was a very great tempest at London and elsewhere, accompanied by coruscations, lightning, and thunder, unquote. Oh, and if that's true, that's incredibly suitable. A great storm was breaking. The great storm of retribution. London had committed everything behind the cause of Simon de Montfort. London had taken to the field to fight against the heir of the throne and the king. London had thrown excrement at the queen, and it had just lost. Oh, this was bad. This was really, really bad. Quickly, steps were taken. Quote, when certain news was heard of the battle aforesaid, all the prisoners who'd been taken at the Battle of Lewes and put into the Tower of London and the Castle of Windsor were set at liberty and released without ransom, unquote. But releasing the prisoners they were holding was not going to cut it. Records say that His Lordship the King had summoned to Windsor, quote, all the earls, barons and knights, as many as he could, with horses and arms, intending to lay siege to the city of London, and by calling the citizens his foes, unquote. By all accounts, at this point, the residents of London began to spiral into a panic. Quote, then was all the city in great alarm. The fools and evil-minded persons, whoever, who'd previously been adherents of the Earl of Leicester against the king, proposed fortifying the city against him. while the discreet men of the city, who had always maintained their fealty to his lordship the king, although some part of them, but by compulsion, had given adherence to said earl, would not assent thereto. But though they sent many letters, through men of religious orders, to his lordship the king, for the purpose of beseeching his favour, it was of no avail to them. Unquote. You can picture the scene, the immediate aftermath of the news of the defeat. The militants actually suggesting they should stand off, hold off the king in a siege, a glorious last stand of London. A stupid hope, since no one would be coming to help them. Luckily, calmer heads prevailed. The idea, however, that they were corresponding via men of religious orders to the king is interesting, and we have reason to know which religious order they were using. Back in 1263, there'd been a massive gathering of the Dominicans over at their monastery in Shoe Lane, just on the edge of the city. Over 700 of them had come to England to attend. 2 years later, I'd like to think that, well, those numbers would have dropped. The high-profile nature of such a large gathering would have made the Dominican monks ideal for the purposes of taking messages to the king. They were, after all, neutrals who could gain an audience with the men around the king. They could send messages, sound out the mood of the royal party. But as the document said, even those who professed loyalty to the king, it was of no avail to them. There were no words of encouragement, no rays of hope. They had chosen the wrong side. The storm of retribution was moving gradually closer to London. Panic meetings were held, one can imagine it. Those who'd been strong supporters of de Montfort and those who had hated the guy, all were in the same boat now. London was facing the terrible wrath of a scorned king, and Henry, they knew, was petty, vindictive, and nasty, but more than that, his son was brutal and very bloody, and was coming direct to London. What the hell could they do now? Quote, at length, after holding counsel amongst themselves, the whole community gave its consent to throwing themselves on the mercy of his lordship the king, and made letters patent thereto, sealed with a common seal. 8 men being selected to carry and show the same unto his lordship the king, and to present such letters to him at Windsor. Upon the road they were met by Sir Roger de Leyburn, who said that he, for the benefit and advantage of the city, had come to make arrangements for peace between his lordship the king and the citizens. Upon hearing which, the men who had been so sent returned home, and the said Roger took up his quarters in the Tower of London, unquote. Roger de Leyburn was one of the knights of England whose political history kind of exposes the vicissitudes of the regime of the king during this era. He'd been in both factions opposed to the king and highly supportive of him as time had gone on. He had eventually ended up with lots of land in Kent and consolidated prestige there, and as such, Roger had fought on the king's side during the Battle of Lewes. He'd been allowed to go free after the battle, provided he turned up at Parliament for trial, but then he didn't turn up, and had been one of the men who had helped Prince Edward escape, and was now, well, as a delegation offering London's wholesale surrender to the king and his son were travelling to Windsor, he was coming from Windsor to them. He was the king's voice in what was to follow. De Leyburn moved straight into the Tower of London. He was the man to whom London now had to deal with. Quote, the next morning, however, the said Roger went to the church called Birking Church, unquote. Birking Church was another name for the Church of All Hallows Barking, which is now more commonly known as All Hallows by the Tower, the large and old church just next door to the Tower of London. It got the Barking connection, it appears, because it had been possibly a sister church established out of the abbey down in Barking. The church's proximity to the Tower of London made it an ideal place to meet the representative of the king. But there was another reason why we think he chose the Church of All Hallows by the Tower. It could have been, and seems to be, somewhere where the regime of Thomas FitzThomas had utilised over the last 4 years. It was, quote, where the mayor and the countless multitude of citizens had met, unquote. So was this church then some kind of place Fitzthomas had organized meetings with a large body of poorer citizens? Was this the church where they'd organized and agreed to form an army, to choose a constable and a marshal, to march out against the king? If it was, then it's a bit like Germany demanding France surrender to them at the middle of World War II in the same rail car the Germans had to surrender at the end of World War I. A little bit of propaganda, a little bit of sending Fitzthomas a clear message. Duly set up then in the Church of All Hallows, Sir Roger, quote, summoning the mayor and the more discreet men of the city, the said Roger said unto them that if it was their wish to become reconciled with his lordship the king, they must wholly subject themselves unto the will of his lordship the king as to life and limb, as to all things inovable and immovable. The citizens accordingly gave assent thereto, and caused letters patents to be mailed, sealed with a common seal, which letters the said Roger took with him to his lordship the king at Windsor, unquote. Total surrender. Total. The city was the king's and the lives of everyone and everything in it was his. There was to be no negotiations now, London. This is your only deal. And of course, London agreed. London prostrated itself before Henry III. It was their only hope. And so the king's negotiator returned to Windsor. And then, quote, afterwards, on the Friday after the Feast of St. Michael, the same Roger came to London, and on the morrow proceeded to the church before mentioned. The mayor also and citizens met there, to whom the same Roger said that it was the desire of his lordship the king that all chains which had been placed across the streets should be removed, and that all the posts which said chains had been attached should be rooted up and carried, all of them, to the tower. And so it was afterwards done. And it was also the wish of his lordship the king that the mayor and principal men of the city should come to him at Windsor to confirm what was said in the letters, unquote. This demand offers us a nice insight into the appearance and state of London during these years. This being the London who had maybe sung the Song of Lewis only a few months before in Ragged Triumph. It was a place where great posts had been driven into the streets and chains laid across them to block off streets, to prevent easy passage along the roads. It's a city in war footing, in armed lockdown. But this was now over. These symbols of London's defiance were not just to be removed, but taken and given to the king's agents in the Tower of London so they can see them removed. And added to this, the king wanted the mayor and the leaders of London to come visit him. Which, yeah, that's a threat. Although, it shouldn't be taken as a threat. Quote, the said Roger also brought letters patent of safe conduct of his lordship the king for the mayor and citizens, so they might safely go to Windsor, there to stay, and thence to return, the same to last until Monday after next ensuing, and throughout the whole Monday aforesaid. Wherefore, on the same day, the mayor and about 40 of the more substantial men of the city set out and arrived at Staines. On the morrow, which was a Sunday, after the citizens had awaited the arrival of said Roger until 9 a.m, he came, and then the mayor and citizens accompanied him to Windsor, where he entered the castle, the citizens remaining without until evening, unquote. Thomas Fitzthomas and the other Londoners clearly feared what was to come. Even if they had letters of safe conduct, there was clearly a very great worry that once they entered Windsor Castle, they were dead men. Even at the entrance to it, they paused, and the king actually had to issue another proclamation to order his men and his followers to do these Londoners no harm. Finally, the mayor and the Londoners decided just to enter. And you know what? They had reason to be worried in the first place. Quote, upon this they entered, and all of them were lodged in the tower in safe custody, the letters of safe conduct granted by the king availing them naught. They also remained there throughout the whole of that night and the whole of the following day, but at a later hour were separated and sent into the bailey of the castle, and there lodged all of them, the mayor excepted, Thomas de Bib Willisden, Michael Thovey, Stephen Bugarell, and John de Fleet, and whose bodies the king gave to Sir Edward, and they remained in the tower, unquote. The leadership of London was now jailed in the dark confines of the Stone Tower of Windsor, the constable of London's armed forces included. The instigators of the rebellious Londoners were now under his and his son's power. The paranoid king was now able to act directly upon London. Quote, after this, his lordship the king departed from Windsor and came to London, calling the citizens his enemies, and giving away more than 60 houses belonging to citizens, they, with all their families, being expelled. In like manner also, he gave away all such goods belonging to the citizens as they possessed without the city. He also took all their foreign lands into his hands, unquote. By foreign lands, the chronicle refers to any land held outside of London by the leading citizens of the city. The thunder of retribution crashed hard upon London. He's taking away houses, he's exiling people, he's seizing property. And the king was not yet done. He, quote, destroyed and wasted all goods there found. At this time, Sir Hugh Fitz-Oates, constable of the Tower, was made warden of the city and styled seneschal, appointing under him two bailiffs, John Adrian and Walter Hervey, who, in place of sheriffs, were to have charge of the city, unquote. So where we'd been talking about mayors and sheriff, they were gone. There was now a seneschal and bailiffs. London was under new management. It had lost all its rights. It had lost all its privileges. This was a brutal destruction of the liberties long fought for and long cherished by the city. They were all dashed upon the altar of retribution. Quote, after this, the citizens aforesaid, who were in the bailey at Windsor, were liberated by leave of his lordship the king and that of his son, and returned home, all of them to London, on the Tuesday after the feast of St. Luke the Evangelist, with the exception of Richard Bonaventure, Simon de Headstroke, William de Kent, Edmund de Essex, and William de Gloucester, who remained, unquote. And so, by the 18th of October 1265, the men in Windsor who had been released, except those five, and we don't know why those five, were allowed to return to the now crushed city. But a new wave of incarceration started as the clampdown on London continued. And you can tell just how furious the king was. For the first time ever, he is so furious with London that he's not actually demanding a fortune in cash. I mean, he's really angry. Quote, at this time, his lordship the king had hostages taken for the keeping of the peace from more than 60 citizens, who accordingly were put into the Tower. And at the same time, had the citizens spoken to, the effect that they make fine to him for their offence, unquote. Oh, look, I spoke too soon. Henry, the hold-up king, has reverted to type. Give me your cash, London. Give me all your cash, London. I have 60 of your citizens in the Tower, and if you so much as look like you're going to cause trouble, I'm going to kill them. And now, pay me, London. Pay me. Now, what I will say, one of the things I most love about this era is the wonderful response to this demand for cash from Henry III, because it actually does capture what would have been some spirited debates between the residents of London to the king's demand. Quote, upon this, upon holding conference, they made answer that the citizens had not equally offended, for some of them had always maintained the peace of his lordship the king, and whom in those times he used to call his friends. Others again had been adherents to the Earl of Leicester, but this because compelled thereto. Many others again, evil-minded persons, had spontaneously sided with said Earl and his accomplices, committing deprivations both within the city and without. Wherefore, it seemed unto the citizens that they ought to not equally be punished. And they accordingly entreated the king and his council that each of them might
individually be allowed to make fine in proportion to his offence, and that everyone might be punished according to his transgressions. And this was granted them, though it was not carried out into effect, unquote. I love it. These weasels, like, I know I did support de Montfort, but I was only forced into it. And the king and his representatives going, there, of course you did. I'm sure the king will understand. And then ignoring it all and issuing his demand. And indeed, that above debate does seem to have come from the rich oligarchs and Esquivins of the city, the men who never supported Thomas FitzThomas, because the ones who had been fully behind the barons, oh, they knew they would not face any mercy. Indeed, the record says, quote, be it remarked that at a time when the city submitted itself unto the mercy of his lordship the king, many persons in the city who had spontaneously sided with the Earl of Leicester took to flight, unquote. Yep. Many of these citizens fled London, maybe forever, maybe until the heat died down, who knows. And who were these people? They were the ones who had, quote, committed deprivations and many mischiefs within the city and without, and in the time of the aforesaid mayor, styling themselves the commons of the city, having had the first voice then, the principal men thereto being of little consulted in reference, unquote. So who was fleeing? The supporters of Mayor FitzThomas, the ones who had been for the last 4 years, basically had told the oligarchs to take a running jump, the ones who had been behind the arming of London's citizens, the ones who had joined the armed forces and marched to war. They fled. And in the end, quote, be it remarked that in the week of our Lord's Nativity in the same year, in presence of Sir Roger de Leyburn and Robert Waldraven, sent by his lordship the king, who was then at Northampton, the citizens made fine to his lordship the king in the sum of 20,000 marks sterling for all the trespasses and excesses during the disturbances of the realm imputed to them in consideration. Therefore, he granted unto them his charter, unquote. As 1265 came to a close, the fine was set. London would be forgiven for about £13,500, a staggering fee. But what could they do? They paid. The city paid. And so things could start again. Please, don't be insane. London had incurred the wrath of King Henry III, but more than that, way more dangerous to the city. They had earned the utter hatred of the heir to the throne, Edward, and he had not even begun to gain his revenge upon these people. And I'm going to end it there. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next week for chapter 99. Bye.